One year ago, in April 2023, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, announced the first criminal indictment of former President Donald Trump.
Donald Trump was arraigned on a New York Supreme Court indictment, returned by a Manhattan grand jury, on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in the first degree.
At the time, even Trump's biggest critics were skeptical of the case. Bragg was charging Trump with 34 felony counts, which is a large number, but the charges also felt like old news. Falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments made to the adult film star Stormy Daniels around the time of the 2016 election. It seemed like there were bigger trials on the horizon in Georgia, Florida, Washington, D.C. It was hard to focus on the so-called Stormy Daniels hush money trial when Trump had allegedly tried to steal an election. But one year later, the New York trial is about to begin. And with Trump's other trials delayed, this one is arguably about to become the most important one. Eric Latch, a staff writer at The New Yorker, is here today to tell us why.
You've seen Trump on TV. You've seen him online. He's this presence in our political culture. In a courtroom, he is just an old guy who has to sit quietly at the defense table. Courtrooms, he doesn't have a lot of power.
You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. Eric, let's start with the basics. What exactly is the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, accusing Donald Trump of here?
So the indictment is a 34-count felony indictment of falsifying business records connected to payments made to an adult film star, Stormy Daniels, around the 2016 election.
And didn't Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, already go to prison for charges related to these payments?
Right.
Like, so that's, remind me what happened with him.
So during the Trump administration, like when Trump was in office, the Justice Department prosecuted Cohen, brought charges against Cohen, who was Trump's former lawyer.
And fixer.
He was doing a lot. I mean, Cohen was this... he was one of Trump's guys. You know, he was one of Trump's guys. He was this kind of attack dog, fixer, all-around kind of nasty operator who worked for Trump and who, you know, was kind of like pledged undying loyalty to Trump. And Cohen pled guilty in that case.
In 2018.
And subsequently, like, publicly broke with Trump and basically pledged revenge.
So, is falsifying documents a felony usually?
Often they are misdemeanors, but in Manhattan, when they're falsified in connection with another crime, they can be bumped up to felonies in the sort of parlance of lawyer talk. These are the kind of counts that often are sort of like the sort of secondary counts in like a criminal case, like a, you know, white collar crime kind of case. It's like a businessman embezzling money or, you know, wire fraud. And then sort of underneath, the cases are kind of bolstered by also allegations of falsifying records. They are not normally charged as felonies. It's very, you know, that's one of the things that makes this case so extraordinary is that this is sort of a novel way of thinking about these crimes. And that's sort of been part of the arm wrestling about this case from the very beginning. The Manhattan DA's office, the way they've been framing this case all along, is like, this is about lying to get into office. Trump is being accused of falsifying these records in order to keep a, you know, hush money scheme under wraps that helped him win the 2016 election.
Trump tried to block Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels from testifying, but the judge rejected that. As far as you know, are they now expected to testify? And if so, what do you think that we can expect from them on the stand?
Yeah, Michael Cohen is in many ways the central figure in this case. Trump's lawyers have, and Trump himself, you know, have for years been painting him as a liar, you know, as a sort of disgruntled former employee, and they're going to want the jury to, like, not believe Cohen. Cohen is a tough cooperating witness. He's done a ton of press. You know, he's done all kinds of things that, like, prosecutors don't love.
Like what?
just talking to the press generally, talking about like the DA's office just showed me all this information and stuff like, you know, just kind of like, you know, trying to, he has sort of inserted himself into the public conversation about this case.
Do you have any question about whether he'll be convicted?
Oh, I believe, based upon the information that I know and based upon not just the documentary evidence, but the corroborating testimony from so many people, I believe that he will be found guilty on all charges.
But he's also went to prison, after pleading guilty to these things. I mean, he's faced serious consequences for his actions and, is going to testify to like what he's already done time for, which I think is a remarkable thing.
Why do you think that Cohen is testifying? What does he get out of this? I know that he kind of turned on Trump a while ago.
It does seem very much that Cohen has turned on Trump and made a decision years ago, you know, to try to inflict maximum pain on Trump, that they had a rupture, that he is now, you know, avenging himself on his former boss. Again, I think that's part of what's going to be incredibly dramatic and compelling about this case. Trump is going to be in the courtroom. Cohen is going to be on the stand, you know, and you'll have this kind of very, very direct confrontation of Trump in a way that we just haven't seen since Trump emerged as a presidential candidate in 2015. The buildup to this has been years in the making.
And what about Stormy Daniels? Like, do we know anything about what she might be like on the stand?
What's she going to be like on the stand? I mean, she has also done, you know, interviews and media, and there's a sort of new documentary about her.
I am Stormy Daniels, adult film star, mom, idiot who can't keep her mouth shut.
Her trajectory through the last couple of years has been, you know, she had her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, who became celebrity kind of political resistance figure when he first emerged, and then, you know, is now in prison. Yeah.
Yeah, he tried to extort Nike.
Yeah.
Who tries to extort Nike?
Yeah. And, you know, so Daniels has given interviews recently talking about, like, you know, she's kind of ended up sort of with nothing through this. This has been this kind of, like, insane public ringer. She's very much taken the tone of, like, I've ended up with nothing, basically.
Who else can we expect to see on the stand besides Daniels and Cohen?
You know, it's sort of like I've been thinking about it as like the kind of like Seinfeld finale, you know, kind of all these characters and bit players sort of returning. Hope Hicks is on there. Various former White House aides are on there. David Pecker, former CEO of AMI, American Media, which owned the National Enquirer. He was the third participant with Cohen and Trump of sort of the scheme. It's sort of going to be, I think, kind of a time travel kind of trial where we're sort of all going to go back to these very high stakes, very chaotic kind of Trump presidency days, all still trying to sort out kind of Trump and his, you know, what he makes people do, what people do on his behalf, and how he kind of exerts his power over all sorts of systems, you know, legal system, political system, his staff, his campaign, with the underlying question of, like, shouldn't there be consequences for some of this?
Well, Eric, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the merits of this case and why this case is so controversial. But first, we're going to take a quick break. You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Eric, what has Trump said so far in response to the allegations that he falsified documents related to this hush money case?
Yeah, I mean, Trump's approach to this case, as in the other criminal cases and the civil cases that he's faced in the last year, has been to basically make every argument possible for why it's bogus and bullshit and wrong and should be dismissed and should be postponed and should be just, you know, just not, you know, in addition to just denials, you know, he has had his lawyers make procedural and constitutional and strategic, every kind of argument that you conceive of. He has sort of dismissed the Manhattan case as a Democratic Party prosecutor coming for him, you know, at the direction of Joe Biden. You know, he's basically tried to graft this case into the larger cosmology of, like, there's a conspiracy to take down Trump, you know, from emanating from the heart of the U.S. government.
He also denies having an affair with Daniels to begin with and has said that these payments were a personal matter, not connected to the election, which, as you mentioned earlier, is going to be one of the big things that is being worked out during the trial.
Right.
So Alvin Bragg has faced a lot of criticism within the legal community for bringing these charges, basically people saying that he's going too far, that the case is too wonky, that it's weak.
Yeah.
Federal prosecutors already charged Cohen and didn't prosecute Trump. Can you get into sort of the history of this case and why it took so long for charges to be brought against Trump and, yeah, what you think of these charges, like how weird they are or how legit they seem?
Right. So one of the questions that has hung over this case all along is sort of why didn't the same federal prosecutors who brought a case against Michael Cohen, in which Trump was identified as the director of the payments for which Cohen pled guilty to.
He was like individual one or something in the
very
documents.
Famously, and it's and a decision was made by federal prosecutors not to bring that case. I think it's still sort of a mystery why they didn't do that. The longstanding DOJ policy is that you're not going to bring a criminal case against a sitting president. And Cohen was prosecuted while Trump was president. The question was, why didn't then prosecutors pick this case up once Trump was no longer president? The Manhattan DA's office, which, you know, basically when Trump leaves office, the Manhattan District Attorney's office starts digging into him. There's a sort of a very deliberate effort in that office to say, you know, if there's a case to be made against Trump, like, we're going to try to make it. This case, the hush money case, is considered early on and then sort of discarded in favor of a case that was about Trump inflating the value of his real estate holdings. The wrinkle in all this is that the Manhattan District Attorney's office, when Trump left office, was led by a district attorney named Cy Vance, who wasn't running for re-election. So basically, as the critical decision-making period is approaching, you're also having like a leadership transition in the Manhattan District Attorney's office. So Alvin Bragg, former prosecutor, presented himself in the DA's race in Manhattan in 2021, wins Democratic primary, then wins the general election, takes over the office, comes into the office, looks at the work that had been done to build a criminal case against Trump for inflating his real estate values, decides not to pursue that case. And sort of very famously, a couple of prosecutors who were working on that case quit in Bragg's early days in office, and sort of sent a very clear message that they basically think Bragg is a coward and is backing out. And this hush money case, which within the office was referred to as the zombie case, it's sort of like the hush money case sort of was picked up and put down several times. And they, you know, for all the reasons that people are debating the merits of the case today, like, those debates were happening internally, sort of like, can we make a felony case out of this? How do we frame this? Is Cohen somebody we want to rely on to sort of bring, you know, a criminal case against a former president in this historically unprecedented way? And one of the prosecutors who quit the DA's office a guy named Mike Pomerantz, publishes a book about the investigation of Trump in the Manhattan DA's office and his role in it and what he thinks of kind of what happened to the investigation, and basically calls out Bragg and basically suggests that Bragg, for political reasons, just didn't want to push forward out of nervousness or out of not wanting to have his whole sort of job become the Trump case. And a couple weeks after this book comes out, Trump's been out of office. There's this question of, like, will the Justice Department prosecute him and to what extent? And everyone's waiting. And the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, like, sort of breaks the seal, you know, and sort of just indicts a former president. This extremely historically, there's no precedent for this in U.S. history. This is like the stakes could not be higher. And Bragg criminally charges Trump. And almost immediately, there's this kind of really, really intense debate about, is this case just, is this too weak? You know, from a political perspective, is it not satisfying? From a legal perspective, is it not robust enough?
I guess I'm just wondering, you know, Trump is facing so many trials at this point. There's the election interference case in Georgia, the D.C. case surrounding the January 6th insurrection, the case in Florida surrounding his handling of classified documents and obstruction of justice. And they have all been delayed. There's something wrong with all of those cases. And this case, the one in Manhattan, which people seem to think could be the weakest case, is also perhaps the only one of Trump's criminal trials that might even happen before the election. I think there's, you know, I think there's very much a chance that that is true. And so why has this case gone forward? I mean, is it just the least complicated in terms of not dealing with classified docs? I mean, what is it about this case that has allowed it to kind of just kind of move forward relatively unencumbered, even though there have been a couple of delays?
Yeah, I mean, so then like sort of to continue the story, it's like this case,
it's like the weakest case, but also the strongest one.
Bragg brings his case. There's a lot of consternation about the strength of the case. And then, but then sort of soon after, Trump is indicted in federal court in Washington, D.C. and in Florida, and then in court in Georgia. And the Manhattan DA's case sort of takes a back seat to all those, because the feeling is like, okay, well, maybe this isn't the strongest case, but like in the context of all these other cases, like, okay, it'll just move forward in sort of the background. Mm-hmm. But then you have this like reversal again in that, yeah, like you say, it's like these other cases for various reasons have been delayed for procedural reasons. And the judge, Juan Marchan, who's overseeing this case in Manhattan, has just kept this one on track.
And Trump has tried to delay it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, even this week, you know, he made a last ditch effort to sort of get it delayed once more. I mean, he's tried many times to get this judge to bite on arguments for delay, and he has just not convinced this judge to go there. And this judge seems, you know, at recent hearings seems just set on getting this done.
I'm wondering, like, what you think of Bragg as a figure and what we're supposed to kind of, like, glean from his decision to charge Trump in such a novel way. I mean, I know that there was some pressure on him after that Pomerantz book came out, but when he first took office, he sort of made a splash by saying that he was no longer going to prosecute low-level offenses like subway fare evasion, resisting arrest, or prostitution unless they were accompanied by a felony charge.
Right. And
now he's using this very novel approach to charge the former president with 34 felonies, which could have easily been misdemeanors.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious what we're supposed to kind of make of his general approach and, you know, like what kind of DA he is.
Yeah, I mean, Bragg, who's a former federal prosecutor, presented himself as one of the more progressive options in a crowded race to replace the incumbent Cy Vance. The Manhattan DA's office very famously does not turn over very, very frequently. There was a guy, Frank Hogan, who ran the office in the middle of the 20th century for many years. And then there was Robert Morgenthau, who was also for several decades running the office, and then Cy Vance for about a decade. And the context is, you know, the 2021 race for the Manhattan DA's office took place in the aftermath of the George Floyd protests in 2020, and very much the kind of what the role of, you know, in the context of like, what's the role of prosecutors and what's their relationship with mass incarceration? You know, Rikers the jail complex in New York City, which is a perpetually dysfunctional, deadly, horrible jail system that we have in the city. Manhattan is one of five boroughs in New York City which feed into the local jail system, but Manhattan was like by far the one sending the most people, Manhattan courts, people to Rikers. And so there was this real question of kind of like, what kind of DA does Manhattan want? Bragg presented himself as a reformer, as a progressive, as somebody who was going to have an eye toward not overcharging and not just sending people away for the sake of sending people away. So the two things that happened to Bragg right after he took office was, one, these prosecutors who were working on the Trump case quit, call him a coward, and then he also issued this very famous day one memo saying that he was going to de-emphasize these kind of low-level prosecutions, which like caused the police department and various factions, more conservative factions of the New York political world, to just protest and say that he was courting disaster. And since then, he's like, I think, really kind of stabilized his much more his position in the city, in sort of in charge of the office. And he, you know, at the sort of preliminary hearings in the Trump case, he's been in the gallery sort of looking over the shoulder of his prosecutors. You know, it's clearly like this is, for him politically and reputationally, like an incredibly high stakes case. You know, that said, everyone's expectation here going into this trial is like it's going to end in a conviction. I don't think that there's quite as much risk for him personally in this, maybe as Willis, you know, the DA in Fulton County, yeah, in Georgia, you know, or Jack Smith, who's prosecuting at the federal level. This case, the expectation is like Trump is going to be found guilty here.
Because it's a Manhattan jury.
Because it's a Manhattan jury, and because, you know, the various arguments that Trump's lawyers have made in the lead up to this case have failed to sway the judge. And so what's the expectation that they'll sway a jury?
And if Trump is convicted, would he be able to pardon himself in this case or no?
Well, no, because this is not, these aren't federal charges. Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of potential sentence could he be looking at?
It's just like so much of this case is just like no one knows because they just,
it's a weird
novel, like, you know, politically charged.
It's like, do you usually go to prison for falsifying business documents? Not if it's a misdemeanor, but if it's a felony, then yes.
So then the opinions vary. You know, opinions vary because he's a first-time offender. You know,
he's old.
He's
and that affects sentencing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and then the other wrinkle is, what would you do with the security detail? You know, he like the former president. I mean, the country has an interest in like the physical security of former presidents. That's sort of the deal. You know, it's like you leave office, you keep your Secret Service detail. Like no one can test that. The stakes of that are kind of like, we don't want these people harm because it's politically destabilizing. You know, you want these people basically protected. How do you put somebody with a security detail in prison?
So, Eric, I want to ask you about how you're personally preparing to cover this trial and what you're going to be on the lookout for. But first, we're going to take another quick break.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Eric, you're getting ready to cover this trial for the long haul. It's like 6 weeks, right? And you're going to be in trial. You're going to be in the courtroom every day. What are you most looking forward to or intrigued by with this case?
I mean, I was saying this after I was at the arraignment last year, and I wish that everybody in the country could get a chance to like sit in the gallery and just observe Trump in a courtroom. It's just, it's like, you know, you've seen Trump on TV, you know, you've seen him online, you know, he's this presence in our political culture and has been in such a powerful way. In a courtroom, he is just like an old guy who has to sit quietly at the defense table and just like, you know, courtrooms, he doesn't have a lot of power, you know, if any, in there as he's sitting there. You know, it's like he's not able to do the kinds of things that he does so successfully in other contexts, make a scene and distract.
Is that true, though? Because you were in the courtroom during the civil trial against Trump where he was found liable for sexual abuse and defamation against Eugene Carroll. And, you know, during that trial, Trump, you know, stormed out of the courtroom during closing arguments, and he would hold these press conferences outside where he would continue to demean Carroll. It seems like, I mean, it seems like he is kind of doing his usual thing in the, maybe during the arraignment, like, you have to be quiet.
But like you said, but then he was found liable at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, yeah. You know, the, like, courts, I think, do this better than, I mean, you know, there's pros and cons to this of the way that the court system works, but they handle distraction much better than the political system. You know, it's like if you're trying to pass a bill and, you know, like one of the opponents of the bill is making a stink or going on cable news and causes some kind of ruckus or whatever, like it could potentially knock off, you know, the momentum of passing a law. But like courts, they understand how to have multi-track proceedings and sort of set things aside. And that's what judges do. This has happened many times in all these Trump, the civil cases and in the preliminary hearings in the criminal cases, you know, where Trump's lawyers very clearly at Trump's behest are trying to, like, you know, belabor some point in a very Trumpian way. Let's go over it again. Like, this is a Joe Biden-led witch hunt, blah, 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 blah. And a judge will just say, we've already discussed this, you know, like, move on. You know, it's like you can't just stay in place. It's like the court has its own momentum. The courts have a way of just moving forward.
And when he goes too far, judges can issue gag orders, which we've already seen.
You know, and that I think is going to be that to me is one of the big questions going into this case, is how far does Trump try to push the judge, and what does the judge do in response? Trump, in the civil cases, the one brought by Eugene Carroll, the writer who said that Trump sexually assaulted her in the 1990s and then defamed her after she wrote about the assault in an article in New York Magazine in 2019. And then in the case brought by the New York State Attorney General, Tish James, by the end of both of those cases, Trump was visibly trying to disrupt proceedings. You know, he was, like you said, I mean, he was like muttering and saying things in the courtroom and jawing with the judge. And
my favorite was in the piece that you did about the jury selection for the Eugene Carroll trial, when the judge at one point vetting potential jurors asked, like, does anyone here think the election was stolen? And then a couple of jurors raised their hands, and then Trump raised his hand too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, being a clown, you know, like, and that
unbelievable,
that kind of behavior increased as Trump realized, in, you know, that the cases were heading, that were going against him, as it became clear that they were going to resolve in, you know, not in the way that he wanted, he just started to act out. And that in a civil context, you know, reached a certain level. And I think that is one of the questions, is now in a criminal case with very, I think, different kinds of stakes. I mean, one of the reasons I think people came around to this case and to the seriousness of it is that Trump seems to treat it very seriously. You know, like the stakes of getting convicted on felony criminal counts, Trump clearly doesn't want that. You know, it's not just something that he's just like, well, it doesn't matter. And, you know, how much will he challenge basically the court? Trump's longtime official at the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg, spent time in jail and is currently going back to jail for, you know, for obstinance, you know, in court and not being straight up in court. In a way, again, like, I think, like, Trump is just like that. That's not being straight up is how he approaches everything else. But in court, the stakes of it are different, and gag orders and contempt of court and, you know, clearing the courtroom and all kinds of other sort of ways that judges have to, like, maintain order. Like, what are we going to see?
Speaking of stakes, I feel like the one thing that we don't talk about enough is just that This is going to have a huge effect on Trump's campaign in the sense that this is going to be 6 weeks straight of him having to go to court every day. Like the other cases we've seen so far, those were civil cases, so he did not have to appear in the courtroom each day. But here he will have to.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what kind of effect you think that his time in the courtroom will have on his campaign.
Yeah. Well,
no, is this going to be bad for him or good for him?
I mean, that's the other thing I think is going to be just fascinating. I mean, this, for better or worse, this is going to be the campaign for him for the next, you know, for the next little bit, at least, you know, like he's going to be the candidate on trial. And, you know, in the civil cases, we saw him try to sort of narrativize that and dramatize that by, like, you know, he'd be in court in Manhattan in the morning and then he'd fly out to a campaign event and he'd, you know, he'd be like, I just came straight from the courtroom where, like, they're, you know, the Joe Biden justice system is coming for me, et cetera. Like that kind of, like, to try to make it a kind of, he's sort of in a crucible and he's sort of the protagonist of this, you know, kind of situation. But every day, you know, there's going to be images and video of him going into the courtroom. And then there's going to be just a, you know, a kind of black box of, like, sort of reports that come out of what happens each day and the witnesses and Trump's behavior and his lawyer's behavior and the prosecutors and the judge. And then there'll be photos and video of him leaving the courtroom.
Yeah, you know? It's not televised. So Trump will be relying on you, Eric, to get his message out there.
No, it's like a very controlled environment. And it's like, it doesn't look, it's like, this is a guy who thinks about, like, optics as a sort of, like, a life, like, philosophy, you know? And it's like, it looks terrible to, like, walk in and out of court every day and lose.
Well, thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you.
Eric Latch is a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can read his work at newyorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter and edited by Stephanie Karayuki, with production assistance from Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.